From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. If you're a person of color or ethnic minority, LGBTQ, a veteran, or a person with a disability, you might face a more dire cancer prognosis or struggle more with chronic disease than someone not in these groups. That's according to the National Institutes of Health. If you're female, you no longer hold a big lead in longevity over the men in your life. In the decade leading up to 2014, the gap between life expectancy for men versus women decreased from 5.1 to 4.8 years. While that might sound positive, it's not. It shows a rise in mortality rates for women for a host of reasons. That's a look at the national picture. In New Hanover County, health officials point to a startling health disparity between the black and white populations. In 2015, African American babies had a mortality rate of 13.5 per 1,000 live births. That's more than three times higher than that of their white counterparts. That's an obvious and easy-to-track health disparity, but we're learning other factors contribute to health outcomes that are not as obvious on the surface. And the local medical community is working to shrink those disparities in health outcome between rich and poor, people of color and people who are white, LGBTQ. My guest today is one of the people leading the charge. Dr. Karen Isaac specializes in family medicine. She's a faculty member in the New Hanover Regional Medical Center Family Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Karen Isaacs, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation during this live Thursday discussion. Are you uncomfortable going to the doctor? Once there, do you feel at ease asking all your questions? Are you intimidated in a medical setting? Why or why not? You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Isaacs, the most shocking thing that you said to our producer, Rachel Keith, is that health outcomes have been a focus for medical providers from the early 2000s. Training medical professionals in cultural competency has been a thing for that time. But despite those efforts, we haven't moved the needle in health disparities. Really? Why?
I think we all sit around scratching our heads wondering the same thing, but it's true. 2003, the Institute of Medicine put out their publication about unequal treatment, confronting racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. And they said, oh, we need to do something about this. This is not right. Let's train our healthcare professionals in a cultural competency. That has to be where we're lacking.
And when we say cultural competency, what do we mean by that?
So that's a good question. Recognizing differences, it's a very vague and kind of generic thing. And being the good, task-oriented folks that we are in healthcare, we checked that box, we attended whatever sessions. But in truth, when we look back at all the medical schools and different healthcare training programs, there was no set training. There was nothing that was defined that would, meet whatever criteria was set for cultural competency.
So it was sort of a vague, this has been a very white approach, white-privileged approach to medicine.
So check yourself and try to do something different and try to think differently and maybe learn a little bit about the Latinos that come in or anyone that's an underrepresented minority. But there was no discrete skill set, I think, beyond that. And so the medical schools were left up to their own devices to figure out what that looked like. What it meant. And, some probably did a fantastic job, and I'm sure some may have just mentioned it once if you were lucky.
What does it mean in practice? Are we learning more about it now? And is you've talked about the shift from cultural competency to cultural humility. What does that mean?
Yes. So that shift is more reflective of the idea that, to think that I can become competent about every individual's culture is a bit arrogant and a bit egotistical and really not realistic. It's much more realistic to recognize that, there's going to be patients that walk in the door that I have no idea what they faced this morning or 2 years ago or when they were young, I have no idea. And it's going to be a struggle for me to figure out how to make a good rapport with them, to figure out how to move forward and how to help elicit what their needs are. And so a lot of it has to do with, as being a healthcare professional, is really recognizing that I need to be more humble about my approach, to ask questions of the folks that I'm working with, and really to put some of my own pride aside so that that I can let the patient speak for themselves and really hear what they're saying.
So in a real world setting, help us understand why that matters and how that might affect the health outcome for a patient. For instance, we know that breast cancer in Black women is less likely to develop, but if it does, that woman of color is more likely to die from breast cancer than a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that African American men are 2.5 times more likely to die of prostate cancer than a white man. So why is that happening? What does the cultural humility of a medical provider have to do with that?
So if I walk into a room and I've already looked through the patient's chart and I know that they're overdue for a preventive screen, for example, a mammogram, to detect whether or not there's breast cancer, I might already come in with my set agenda and my usual approach and assume that the patient is there to take advice from me and that whatever I recommend and you know, advise them to do, that they're going to say yes and they're going to walk out of there and they're going to do it and they're going to get it done. And without really taking the time to explore how they feel about that, do they know anyone that's had breast cancer? Do they have any other personal experience, anyone in their family or friends that they were close to? Anything that might impact their decision whether or not to actually follow my advice is potentially a big missed point in my care if I don't take the time to do that. Because if I haven't figured out something that might stand in the way of them actually completing that screening, then neither of us are in any better spot. That patient hasn't gotten their screen done, and I haven't taken the time to figure out, you know, how we can approach whatever is in their mind about, you know, well, is it going to hurt? Is it going to cost money? Is my insurance going to pay for it completely? If I have it, I don't want to know that I have it because I've seen my good friend go through breast cancer treatment, and it was horrible.
And she died anyway.
Right, right.
Yeah. So then how do you get past something like that as a healthcare provider, if someone's even willing to tell you that? I mean, I can also envision a scenario where they'll say, yes, I know I need to do that. Okay, sure. I'll make the appointment. Thanks so much.
Yes.
And not follow through.
Right.
So how does your understanding of that person's actual circumstances change what they might do?
Sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you don't know until you see them again or you come across their chart and you're like, oh my gosh, they never got that screening. I wonder what happened. I wonder what came up. Did something happen that just took their mind away from their own personal self-care? Or was there something deeper that maybe I missed? And so sometimes you don't know. Healthcare providers that are savvy and or maybe don't feel rushed in their day-to-day activities might have a little bit more time to take and say, hey, so this was, you know, kind of what we recommend. How do you feel about that? What do you think? Do you have any questions? So kind of reflecting back to them the opportunity to fill in that space of, you know, is this something that you think you would agree with that you can go do? Or do you have any questions about that?
So that sounds like a healthcare provider, a doctor, trying to facilitate a real conversation with a patient, like a dialogue instead of a talking to.
Sure.
Which is different from what a lot of us grew up with.
Yes.
Even those of us who grew up in a relatively privileged white, there was still a power dynamic. Can you kind of talk about that power dynamic between doctor and patient?
Yes. Yeah, so a lot, to put a lot of this, I think some patients, just like a healthcare provider might have an agenda when they come into the room, the patient might have their initial first impression of you when you walk in the room as a healthcare provider. They might think that they have you pegged. I don't trust this healthcare provider. I don't want to hurt their feelings, so I'm just going to politely nod my head and say, yep, I can get that done, and not really open up because you assume that the healthcare provider doesn't really understand where you're coming from or doesn't really care or
right.
Can't do anything about it, which is the more helpless feeling.
Right. and perhaps only has 2 minutes to spend with a patient.
Right.
There is that sort of okay, you got any questions? You understand what I said? Now, next.
Yes.
So
it's a hard habit to break.
Yeah. Now, is that a function of the system? That sort of, not building in time to have actual dialogue with patients? Or is that, how do you change something like that?
I do think, by and large, it is a reflection of the system. You know, we've health administrators who go through a lot of schooling and training to figure out how do we keep these healthcare systems afloat financially, and they have these formulas where they decide how many patients you have to see in a day's time. Not every place has that type of framework, and it all depends on who funds them and who makes the decisions. But in general, we do have to see patients in order to keep our doors open. That short amount of time, it's hard. I don't know how to fix it, to be honest. I think for me personally, day in and day out, I invite my patients to sign up for the portal, for example, which is a web-based way for them to be able to ask questions that we might not have had time to get to, or even, a few weeks later that comes up. But of course, then you have patients that say, I don't have a computer at home, or I don't have access to the internet, or I don't know how to sign up for it. I mean, things that we take for granted as being pretty easy, and most of us have cell phones, not every patient feels comfortable doing.
Right. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at disparities in health outcomes among genders, ethnicities, and other minority group members. NHRMC's Dr. Karen Isaacs is with us today and answering your questions on this Thursday. When we return from the break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Medical professionals have known for nearly two decades that people of color or people with a disability or military veterans or members of the LGBTQ community are more likely to suffer and die from their diseases than white people. And the age that women die is going down. And that was a little bit of a technical glitch that we have from time to time. Today, we're looking at why these health disparities exist and what the local medical community is doing about it. Dr. Karen Isaacs is a faculty member at NHRMC's Family Medicine Residency Program, and she's answering your questions on this Thursday. You can weigh in or ask your own question by calling us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Isaacs, the kind of conversation that you would have with someone who is facing homelessness would be different from the kind of conversation you would have with someone who is not, who has a secure place to live, even if those two people have the same medical issue. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, with homelessness, you certainly have a lot more unpredictability about, if they need medications, where are those medications stored? Are they secure? Do they need refrigeration? If they're homeless, do they even have access to transportation to get the other ancillary services they need or get to the pharmacy or even to their appointments for that matter?
Is it hard to get a patient to tell you that kind of thing? I would imagine there's a certain amount of shame in that.
So if you ask, I think most patients are straightforward. I think most of us have a lot of implicit bias when we walk into the room. And I think we make assumptions. This person doesn't seem like they have housing security issues. So unless we ask, we don't ever fully know. And I don't think a lot of patients automatically volunteer that information. They may not always have the foresight to understand that our recommendations are going to be related to whether or not they have housing security. Sometimes they will, and sometimes they're very forthcoming with requests for help in general, whether it's case management or what other resources in the community that they can be linked to.
So if we use an example of someone who is diabetic and needing insulin, mm-hmm. if that person is homeless, then you wouldn't necessarily give them a prescription for insulin that needs to be refrigerated. What would you do?
So that's certainly a consideration. It's just avoiding it completely. Versus maybe someone has some housing insecurity, but they do have something stable for the next month. So really getting to the details and the nitty-gritty and asking the patient what they think they can manage versus just avoiding it completely if it's not going to work for them, you know, going to the next best thing. And sometimes it's about harm reduction rather than perfect health outcomes. If I can at least keep their blood sugars better than in the thousands, you know, if I can at least keep them maybe in the, you know, 200 to 300s rather than being, you know, perfectly at 120, that at least is harm reduction for them and might help keep them out of the hospital for a diabetic emergency, for example.
We know that health outcomes for people who are members of the LGBTQ community are generally not as good mm-hmm. as people who are not. Why is that?
Oh, that's a good question. And so I'm going to write myself a note to get back to your question, but let me just preface that with, you know, I should have said this earlier with introducing myself as a cisgender white female physician, because I think it has a lot to express to others who might be listening about the kind of privilege that I have coming into this discussion, and that I recognize that. And so I am an ally to the LGBTQ community. I can't say that I know firsthand all of the barriers and discriminations and the injustices that they face. So why they might face worse health outcomes, I think, is not even feeling like they have a place that they can go without being judged, where they can go in and be called their name and their preferred pronouns and receive care that's affirming without being questioned or felt like they were having to jump through hoops to get the appropriate access to care.
Can you give us an example of that? Just why someone, and I realize it's more obviously complicated with someone who might be transgender, but someone, let's say a gay man or a gay woman, we know still that there are issues there. Part of it, as you say, is the patient feeling judged by the medical provider. But how does that impact just going in for, say, an annual checkup?
Again, I think it depends on the individual person coming in as a patient. If they feel like they're going to be asked questions related to their sexual orientation that has nothing to do with their overall care, it gets irritating. You know, we talk about these microaggressions that a lot of underrepresented minorities or sexual orientation or gender identity, those patients and those persons feel just because of what historically has been in place through our social norms.
Can you give us an example of a microaggression?
Good. So one example would be if myself as a white woman, if I looked at a male teenager who wasn't obviously white, and if I said, oh, what are you? And so, of course, the person is not a what, right?
Right.
And but I'm wanting to put this label on them because that's how my brain might have thought socially and historically. If we need to fill out a form, what are you? Well, the person would probably be annoyed by that and say, "Well, I'm a human being. You know, don't say I'm a what. I'm a person. I'm a human being. And is it even relevant to what care you're trying to provide for me right now?" And so that's an example of a microaggression.
Yeah, in the Sun, a literary magazine out of North Carolina, run mostly, by the way, by white men. The magazine recently interviewed Dorothy Roberts, who is a professor of law and sociology at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the founder of the Penn Program on Race, Science, and Society. And she says that medical professionals, geneticists, criminologists, sociologists, and psychologists who don't think of themselves as racist still find it hard to conceive of doing their work without categorizing people by race. Doctors ask, how can I treat people without taking their race into account? Researchers ask, how can I do this study without having subjects tick the box to indicate race? By treating race, says Professor Roberts, as if it were an essential, innate part of who we are, these people are upholding institutions and ideas that perpetuate inequality. And she gives an example of a person of color being misdiagnosed with a respiratory infection when this person actually had cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. But black people don't have cystic fibrosis. So can you help us understand that? Because in the beginning of this program, we talked about cultural humility and recognizing that there are cultural differences among people. Mm-hmm. Of different ethnicities and, you know, cultural traditions. So what does a medical professional do with that? How do you acknowledge it and not acknowledge it? Or
so as a healthcare professional, I actually think it's not too dissimilar from maybe those, you know, researchers in sociology or anthropology or whoever, because it is true that there's very little genetically about different races that predispose them to different diseases. There are, of course, a few examples. Cystic fibrosis, but it doesn't mean that you can't be black and have cystic fibrosis. Just like you also can see a white person with sickle cell disease. Not very common, but it can happen. So even in healthcare, you know, when we're training our students and our residents, it's a question in my head of like, how important is it when you're presenting a patient to me to tell me what their race is? Is it even relevant to their overall, you know, impression of what's going on with the patient? Is it, and like I said, there's a few cases where we know some conditions are more clumped with certain racial or ethnic minorities, but by and large, not terribly so. On the flip side, though, I do think it's important from a research perspective and a healthcare perspective in terms of data collection to understand who is facing what amounts of certain medical conditions, for example. So in a way of reflecting back on the data and making it transparent, particularly when we talk about health inequities, which groups are facing the bigger problems, because that will help illuminate for us where do we need to work on.
Okay, so we know in New Hanover County we need to work on the infant mortality rate born to African American women. How do we work on that?
I wish I knew the answer. When you want to think about working on a health disparity, and you have to really think on multiple different levels. You have to think, all right, when you're at the level of talking about mortality, we are so far downstream that there's not a whole lot of super meaningful interventions that are probably going to move that needle.
You're talking about the doctors, the medical
right,
doctors
right.
being so far downstream.
Right.
Okay.
So downstream, making sure there's access, making sure there's competent doctors who can diagnose and treat and prescribe and, you know, manage and all that stuff. But you really have to think also more upstream, which is out of the hands of a lot of healthcare professionals. You think about things that are upstream that have to do with health messaging that patients might be getting or the general public might be getting. In terms of what causes disease and mortality, you know, you think about genetics and health behaviors, and that's maybe like 30% of what contributes to overall mortality. You think about living conditions, physical environments, economic opportunities, land use, and then even more upstream, you have the institutional inequities of what kind of government policies are in place, what kind of laws are in place. And even further upstream, we have what we touched upon, which is the social inequities in terms of labeling and classes and race, sexual orientation, gender. So that's a long answer for how to think about it. But, you know, you have to think about where you are along this stream, if I can use that analogy. So downstream, when the bad health outcomes are happening, you know, we've missed probably a lot of opportunities upstream for potential intervention.
Land use has an impact on my mortality?
Yes.
Tell me how.
Well, when you think about, you know, is land set aside for safe in green parks where people can exercise, but not only exercise, but also de-stress? Or are you living right next to a big industry that might have some questionable chemical emissions coming from it, for example? Or are you living in an area where there's no escape from violence, mm-hmm. for example? So how city planning goes into effect and how they make those decisions about land use absolutely can affect. In fact, there's even down to zip codes. There's these theories and hypotheses that a lot of times you can predict someone's average health expected a lifespan based on the zip code that they live in.
Don writes, to what extent has the poor access to healthy and affordable foods caused by food deserts in communities caused the disparity in health outcomes in certain neighborhoods?
So I think that's a great question, and one that I've been blessed firsthand to kind of see some of the collaborative efforts going on through our clinic and the hospital and some of the organizations in the community. I can't give a percent, but I definitely think that education around nutrition in general is lacking. I think that access to healthy, fresh foods is not always ideal. There's a lot of times where patients will cite for me the cost impact differential between buying, you know, canned foods or high sodium foods that might push up their blood pressure or whatever it might be, versus having to get on an extra transportation to try to seek out the more fresh food that is hard to find for them.
Right, and takes longer to prepare.
It can for some people if you don't know how to do it. A lot of it has to do with habits and how we're raised and what we think is healthy and nurturing to our bodies. So, yeah, there's differences of opinion out there. I don't have an exact percentage for what contributes to it, but we do know that in New Hanover, that certainly the food deserts are significant. And whereas we can sometimes think about certain zip codes as being risk areas, what I'm finding when we're starting to screen our patients in our clinic is that there's pockets, even outside of these hotspot food deserts that we know about, there's certainly pockets all around of people that are facing. And even, again, if you don't ask, you don't know. And so when we've started asking, I've been really surprised at how many patients have admitted to some form of food insecurity.
You're listening to Coastline. Health disparities among different races, genders, other minority groups are as prevalent as they were when health professionals first started examining the issue nearly two decades ago. We have Dr. Karen Isaacs with us today. She's a faculty member in the NHRMC Family Medicine Residency Program. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. The National Center for Biotechnology Information, which is part of NIH, reports that in 2014, life expectancy at birth was 81.2 years for women and 76.4 for men. From 04 to 14, the gap in life expectancy between men and women shrunk from 5.1 to 4.8 years. And of course, the researchers point to this as a troubling statistic. It doesn't mean that men are living longer. It means women are dying younger. Do we know why that's happening and what some of the gaps are with just women across the board in medical treatment?
You know, that's a statistic that I don't know that we actually know the answer for. I'm sure there's multiple layers to it rather than just gender alone. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally you had mentioned being able to escape violence as a factor in mortality. And I think one of the things they talk about is that women are facing more violence now in parts of their life than they ever have before. And depression is a factor. Mm-hmm. Yesterday we learned from a clinical neuropsychologist that long-term chronic depression might be an indicator of brain injury or cause a decline in brain health. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you as a family care specialist when you're talking with a patient? Do you need to look for those sorts of things?
Absolutely. There is an incredible link between mental and emotional well-being and physical well-being. 100%, yes. This is not necessarily something that I would open up the can of worms with the patient directly, but while providing care with patients, I certainly do think about what kind of chronic stress have they lived through up until the point that they are today seeing me in a patient encounter. You know, did they grow up in toxic stress environment? And toxic doesn't mean that you were watching a bunch of, or you were exposed to a bunch of fighting or, you know, drug use. It could even just mean that you were neglected or you just didn't get the early interventions that you needed as a child. So what kind of environment were they raised in? How many other opportunities were they given? What other microaggressions, if they were in any of these other underrepresented groups, might they have experienced? Because there are very incredibly fascinating studies that show that there's a link between these chronic stresses of whether it's real or perceived racism and discrimination and bias at a cellular level of someone's body in terms of putting them at risk for future disease states. And at first when I heard that, I just thought, oh, this is just a bunch of, who came up with this? I didn't believe it. But I think there is something to it. And the more you recognize that there is these harder to put your finger on diagnoses, like for example, a good one might be fibromyalgia, for example. Fibromyalgia is a condition where a patient experiences a lot of pain to the extent that there's no tests that confirm anything that is underlying the pain sensation that they're having. So it's often a diagnosis that we settle on when we rule everything else out.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring health disparities in the Cape Fear region with NHRMC's Dr. Karen Isaacs. You can ask your own question by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org or calling us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring health disparities today and what local medical professionals are trying to do about it with Dr. Karen Isaacs. She's a faculty member at the New Hanover Regional Medical Center Family Medicine Residency Program, and she's answering your questions during the live Thursday discussion. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. People who have disabilities are one of those groups that tend to suffer more from health disparities. According to the NIH, adults with disabilities are four times as likely as adults with no disabilities to report having fair or poor health. They also report higher rates of obesity, lack of physical activity, smoking, and three to four times the rate of cardiovascular disease versus people without disabilities. How can a medical professional understanding more about a person suffering from a disability start to help someone cope with this?
Disabilities can vary widely and hugely. So it's hard to have a one-size-fits-all approach, especially when your approach is not really inclusive of people with disabilities. It may be that their disability is related to language or cognition. And so even being able to get out the full story might take longer than that, you know, 2 minutes that you have to spend with the patient. So forcing them to fit into that box that you need them to be as a patient doesn't always work out to their favor. Or to your favor, really, you're not doing anyone much help by doing that. So I think a lot of our job as healthcare providers, that whether we choose to accept it or not, is to really be advocates for our patients. And if we need to block aside another appointment in order to accommodate their needs, or even, you know, our clinic does kind of an innovative project. Well, it's not really innovative. It was the old way of providing medicine, but doing home visits. being able to actually travel to patients' homes and meet them in their own environment, especially if their disability is something physical that makes it really challenging to get into the clinic to begin with.
People with disabilities, including those with health insurance and without, were more than twice as likely as people without disabilities to not get medical care because of cost. That statistic is from 2009. As a medical provider, how can you, without becoming a volunteer, do anything about that?
It's tough. It's tough. It's, again, it's one of those things where you can be an advocate. You know, a lot of times if it's something we weren't ever trained in or no one ever taught us specifically, it's hard to get out of your routine and take time to go look things up and figure out, okay, they have this, maybe they have Blue Cross insurance and I need to go figure out with their payer, Blue Cross company in North Carolina, what criteria do we need to meet to show that this should be covered under their insurance versus the next best, you know, alternative that might be available to them.
You are collecting data now, right?
Yes.
As the result of a grant. And what kind of data are you collecting and what are you hoping to learn?
What I'm doing is actually rolled into a year-long fellowship in health equity. So it's not necessarily a grant, but it is a project that's longitudinal. And I've partnered with the hospital who is working from a state level, from the Department of Health and Human Services, about how to ask questions about social determinants of health in a routine screening way during patient visits. So right now, we know there's hundreds of different things that can qualify as a social determinant of health. We've got it narrowed down to a slim 4 items. So we ask about any interpersonal violence in the past 12 months, difficulty with transportation that affects their health care, difficulty with housing, and then food insecurity question.
And when they answer those questions, then what do you do with that data?
So right now we're simply in the collecting phase. We have some limitations about how much further we can go with information. We have planned to implement a health navigator with the assistance of the local Community Care of North Carolina for the Lower Cape Fear. They would help staff a health navigator for us so that we could make referrals formally for anyone who had a positive screen so they could help them navigate the community system with referrals to resources that might be appropriate for their needs. We also have taken advantage of a partnership between the hospital and Nourish NC in order to provide the starter food boxes. This is what I call them, the starter boxes, that just has food. And this is for any pediatric patient whose parent or guardian may have screened positive for them. Age 0 to 18, we can start them on that process of getting access to that food box and then hopefully ongoing connect them to Nourish NC directly so they can get ongoing assistance from them.
So you're trying to expand the care then upstream, as you talked about before.
Sure. Understanding, again, because we're located so far downstream, you know, a lot of the patients, with the exception of children, a lot of our patients are sick. And so what we're doing is even, and there's been studies that show even after making improvements in healthcare, if upstream social inequities continue to persist, then those patients are still at risk for worse outcomes. So even if we're moving the needle a little bit downstream, there also has to be a concurrent or, you know, at the same time, some larger scale policy changes and community work around the upstream variables that are affecting outcomes.
We have an email from Sarah who says, "I am a trans woman and have experience with harassment from healthcare workers. In February, I was in the New Hanover Regional Hospital ICU. I was treated with respect and compassion. Disparities do exist, but it is getting better." That's hopeful.
It gives me goosebumps. I'm terribly sorry for having been harassed. And that is real. It is not just one person's experience. It is certainly Sarah's experience, but we know.
How does that happen? What is said? It's very hard to imagine harassment in a medical setting for those of us who don't fall into some of those categories that are bullied and harassed and face more violence.
And we know it's happening. We also know that it's happening in the legal system. And again, two places where you think you should be safe. and you should be entitled to some protection, and you're not necessarily.
And that leads to, I want to ask you this, you're talking about really getting into understanding a patient, approaching the patient with a certain amount of cultural humility and asking more questions and trying to create an atmosphere of where the patient has a dialogue. How do you create a safe space for a patient who may be engaging in high risk or destructive behavior and give them the message that you need to give them, but not come off as judgy?
I think number one is remembering to, as a health professional, to only ask questions that are relevant, and then explaining the relevance, which may not be obvious. Otherwise,
so talking about it in kind of a clinical, scientific,
right?
These
right.
are the likely outcomes of this behavior.
Right. I might ask a patient, you know, how many times have you done drugs in the past month, for example, and I might then narrow it down to, has any of that been IV drug use? And I might be only asking that if they're having fevers or body aches or something that might make me think that IV drug use could therefore be a risk for some of their symptoms that they're having, and I don't want to know that they have bacteria in their bloodstream or something. So again, asking only the questions that are really relevant to why they came in, and then explaining to them why it's helpful for you to know that information so that they're not left wondering.
Medicare and Medicaid, it's getting harder and harder to find local healthcare providers who will accept that form of insurance, which is a big issue of access for some people. What's the answer? and is this something that people are widely aware of? Are medical professionals aware of this in the community, that it's getting harder and harder to find those?
I mean, I tend to think health professionals are aware of it. And again, sometimes a health professional might be working in an organization where the health professional isn't making the decisions about how many Medicaid or Medicare patients to take. So sometimes it's out of the hands of the healthcare professional. And again, a lot of it is tied to money. And the solution really depends on who you ask. I think it's been clear that North Carolina was one of the states that did not expand their Medicaid program, which was unfortunate for a large number of patients and persons in our population.
Although there are some new discussions underway, I should say,
yes.
at the legislature,
yeah.
there is more discussion about that, and I think a recognition that there may be a way to do this that makes fiscal sense.
Yeah, hope so.
That's the latest. The NIH points to collaborative relationships between smaller community states and the federal government in terms of getting to better health outcomes. The greatest progress in reducing tobacco use in the U.S. happened, according to the NIH, when local smoking control ordinances were combined with state and federal efforts to increase tobacco taxes. So the taxes not only made the cigarettes more expensive, they also helped fund ad campaigns warning people of the dangers of smoking, supported smoking quit lines. So it was this multi-pronged mm-hmm. effort to change policy, backed by a communication and educational strategy. Are there elements of that the Cape Fear region could kind of be a kickstarter of?
Absolutely. I definitely think that is the direction that we need to go in. It takes a special set of people that are good at moving and shaking and organizing and making those partnerships and those collaborations to really be successful, I think. And I think I've only just recently become aware, I think it's the New Hanover County Task Force on Resiliency.
Yeah.
I've just only recently become aware of them, of all things, despite my health equity interests. But I think that's an example where some really positive, fruitful, collaborative efforts could come through.
And speaking of resiliency, Senator Harper Peterson, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, Rachel, and good afternoon, Dr. Isaacs. Wanted to ask you about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and the impact that has on health, adult health. There's been quite a bit of research. I'll leave it there if you want to just expand on that.
That's an important element of it. Thanks so much, Senator Peterson.
Right. So ACEs, also known as adverse childhood events, very similar to that toxic stress that I referred to earlier in our program. Again, it could be seeing marital discord amongst your parents. It could be seeing neglect. It could be seeing violence. It could be an absent parent, whether they're they've left or they're in jail. Lots of different factors will qualify as an adverse childhood event. And it definitely not only impacts them in early childhood, especially if we miss those opportunities for early childhood intervention, but we know that it cumulatively impacts their risk for health conditions as an adult. And so, yes, you might have someone who went through the foster care system and they were the one example of someone who's really beat the odds and they've been resilient, but that's not the usual course of events. A lot of times it definitely puts them at higher risk for just conditions in general, but also the inability to really effectively engage in self-care and to be able to advocate for themselves. So adverse childhood events is a significant epidemic that I don't think that we have totally gotten the best tools together with, even for our adult patients. For children, we have programs, but for our adults, you know, a lot of times I suspect an adverse childhood event, but, you know, I have people say, well, why didn't you screen for it? And I'm like, well, what am I going to do about it? You know, how do you, it's really difficult to have that discussion and say, well, look, I think you're a product today of all of the different impacts that you've had negatively from your childhood and beyond. You know, the patient's going to look at me like, so what? What does that, you know, who cares? You know, I can't change that. But there are some therapy techniques that I believe have been helpful for patients that are willing and understanding of that concept. But it's a hard discussion to have with a patient.
And it's a hard discussion to have because it's hard to get them to open up about it, or because once they do,
I think I think a little bit is about how hard it is to open up about past factors and whether or not you're willing to accept if that's affected you today. But again, thinking about, well, so what are you going to do about my diabetes today? You know, yes, I might have had adverse childhood events, but I'm stuck with what I'm stuck with today. What do we do about that? And so it really depends on the situation in terms of how far we can go with addressing adverse childhood events that happened previously.
And we just have a minute or so left, but the military veteran population, this is a vulnerable population and a growing one. And we know they experience lasting trauma from their military service. And yesterday we just learned that there are 53 other ways that we didn't know about before that they can get brain injuries, you know, impacts from IEDs that didn't even hit them just through the audio waves. So when you're looking at that and then they come back here and often face socioeconomic disadvantages, how can the local medical professionals enter into that kind of a circumstance or that kind of a conversation with understanding and help these folks?
I think even just recognizing that having been in the military puts them in a risk category. Because I know even during my training, I didn't necessarily recognize that, nor did I totally understand the infrastructure around how they access healthcare, who pays for it. You know, I was under the training concept of, you know, you have a primary care provider and you should only see that one person. But a lot of times with their inability to access care from the VA at all times of the day, you know, a lot of times they're encouraged to seek out primary care providers in the community.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Dr. Karen Isaacs, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Yeah.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.